Blog Talk Radio.
Spend some time in the country. We're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country. Leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone. The best in music, too. Spend some time in the country. We've been waiting here for you. Here in the country, waiting here for you.
You found the place for up-close and personal interviews with your favorite country stars. This is In the Country, hosted by Dave Wood. Stay tuned for great stories and great music. Now live from Ontario and heard around the world, welcome to the show.
Dr. Jocelyn Neal is an associate professor of music at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She holds a BA from Rice University and an MA and PhD from the Eastman School of Music at University of Rochester. She's the author of The Songs of Jimmie Rodgers, A Legacy in Country Music, which received an ASCAP Deans Taylor Award and an ARSC Award, and she's co-author of the third revised edition of Country Music USA. Dr. Neal regularly presents at national conferences on popular music and analysis. She joins me on the show today to talk about various aspects of traditional and contemporary country music. Welcome, Jocelyn.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. I'm looking forward to this. I know that at the university, you cover a lot of different aspects to do with country music, and maybe you can talk about that and also a couple of those books that you've written and co-authored.
Sure. I feel very lucky to be at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's a great place. We've got a lot of students who are interested in popular music, and more importantly for my research, interested in country music. And there's such a rich tradition in this area, and of course some archives on campus as well, that I've had a lot of opportunities to teach classes that maybe I wouldn't have had at other universities. Perhaps the most fun of those is a large undergraduate course just in the history of country music. It's designed for non-music majors, and so I get a chance to interact with students from all across campus in that course. And you ask about some of the books I've had the privilege of working on. And that research goes back, well, till probably 15, 20 years now for me. I got interested in Jimmie Rodgers, but I was also interested in very contemporary music. So my interests fell on both ends of the chronological spectrum, the beginning of recorded country music and the very recent stuff of today. And I've been lucky to get to write about both ends of that century, basically.
It's great to be able to trace the beginnings and to present and see all the common themes and threads that are throughout.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I think that's the most interesting part for me. A lot of people are interested in individual biographies or particular eras in country music's history, and I'm very interested in the lines that trace, as you said, through the whole history of the recorded music.
Now the book, The Songs of Jimmie Rodgers, A Legacy in Country Music, now that must have been a great book to write and to get feedback on, because you're dealing with someone who sort of started things off. He is known as the father of country music.
Absolutely, and people who listened to country way back when regard him as this hero, and yet a lot of artists today and a lot of fans today haven't heard of him, because in a lot of situations when we're listening to country radio or if we're just browsing in a record store, often people who are fans of today's country music don't go back that far in their listening. And so there's a lot of people who hadn't discovered his music and known that it was his, although they perhaps know the songs because they've gotten covered so many times in the intervening 80 years.
Yeah, the one thing I do love about country music is that, now some fans choose to just listen to what's contemporary, but it is really interesting to know the history of it and to see, you know, from Jimmie Rodgers to Hank Williams, George Jones, and Garth Brooks, and as we sort of follow things through. So it's great to know the history and understand where the music started and how it evolved.
Absolutely, and I always try to keep in mind that while the commercial recording business started for country music in the 1920s, the actual musical traditions go back far, much, much further. So we only actually have, in terms of what we can hear, from the 1920s onward, and then there's all that other music that led to that, which we have in various oral history accounts or perhaps in some sheet music, but we can't actually hear it anymore.
Right. Right. Now, when we went from Jimmie Rodgers, who you write about, and we move into the era of Hank Williams, which is a bit later in country music history, what was Hank's impact on country music, the contributions, and, of course, there was controversy with him as an artist as well?
there's controversy with all the country artists, I think. I like looking at that Hank Williams era, which, you know, he starts recording in about 1946, and he's on the Opry in 1949. And so that's right after World War II, and it's a time period when American popular culture is changing tremendously. And Hank Williams is one of the last of the country stars who we meet and then who, unfortunately, we lose at an early age because he's dead in 1953, before the advent of rock and roll and before popular music really changes radically in the mid-50s. So Hank's working at this very, very interesting time period. It's after World War II. It's almost the age of television, but not quite for most Americans. And it's before rock and roll hits. And so we have this nostalgic memory of that time period, and especially of country music and the honky-tonk music that happened before Elvis Presley literally shook things up.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. And what would you say his biggest contribution is? Is it the songs and the songwriting? Because, of course, he wrote most of his songs, and they're classics, and many people still perform them today. And Jimmy Buffett and friends did a version of Hey Good Lookin' just a couple of years back.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of the legacy of his songwriting, that's one of the things a lot of people talk about. I also like to keep in mind that he was working with a producer, Fred Rose, who probably doctored a number of his songs as well. And so what we remember as Hank Williams' songs were really the product of more than just one person or one mind there. And Fred Rose had a lot of more classical training and had worked in popular music in a number of different places before landing in Nashville and long before meeting Hank Williams. But I think that one of the things Hank Williams leaves for country fans as part of his legacy is the almost the myth and the stories that we remember so vividly about him. Yes, we remember his music and his recordings, and yes, people have covered his songs in the intervening half century, but the fact that he lived this very short, very troubled life and sang about it, a lot of what we know now as country music makes people believe that the songs and the person are so closely linked, and that legacy
right. Comes
primarily from Hank Williams. That's where we start to think of the singer and the character or the protagonist in the song as one and the same, and we start to believe that idea of first-person storytelling really deeply.
And it definitely seemed with Hank Williams and with some others, including George Jones, that they really lived what their songs were about, the heartache, the drinking. They weren't just singing these songs because it was country music and that's what you do. They were actually going through it.
A lot of fans really love that about some of those honky-tonk artists, that they feel like those artists are singing directly from first-person experience. So for a lot of country fans, that becomes a very important characteristic of the music, and they tend to value country music where they feel that that's in place. And for other fans, that's not so important. And at other time periods in country music history, a lot of our biggest stars have not written their own songs or have perhaps not lived lives that were as troubled as the few that you just named.
Right.
And so other fans don't see that as being quite as important in the way that they value their music.
Yeah, I guess we have to identify with whichever artist. In some cases, it could be a Hank Williams, either identifying or just enjoying the music, or somebody contemporary like a Taylor Swift. The music might be a little more positive, maybe more about young love, but whatever we gravitate towards, I guess, is the music we like.
Absolutely, and I always try to keep in mind that there are so many different audiences and individuals, and the way that each of us connects to our country music is going to be a little bit different. There are a lot of people who come to become country fans a little bit later in life. Maybe they listened to some other genre as teenagers, early 20s, all through those college years. And there's a certain group of people who become country fans maybe mid-20s or into their 30s when their lives are changing, and they're going to find
right. Something
some kind of synergy in some country music that maybe talks about issues of family, and a lot of country music talks about the generations, how you relate with children and with your aging parents and things. So that's going to be a different group of fans, and there's a lot of overlap, and certainly people might like more than one type of music. But then there are other fans for whom different styles of country music and different stories speak to them. So there's never one country audience or any one type of fan.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's what I found too with country music. There's you've got the pop country, the rock country, alt country, bluegrass in there. So you have something different for everybody. And country radio through the years, as I listened, and through the 80s in particular, you know, you had Kenny Rogers, Alabama, George Jones. So you sort of had some people more traditional than others. Has that always been, and how far back does that go, sort of that, not necessarily a battle, but that tug of war, I guess, between pop and traditional country?
I think that goes all the way back to the very, very first years of the recordings. So a lot of those record producers in the 1920s were very specifically looking for music that they considered old time and that they considered very much untainted by urban or commercial forces. And at the same time, some of the artists that they were recording, including Jimmy Rogers, these artists saw themselves as contemporary popular singers. They didn't see themselves as representing something that was old or somehow non-contemporary. And that tension between what we might describe as sort of a roots country and a pop country, that goes all the way back. But it really starts to manifest probably in the 1930s when we first get country artists that are actually working also as pop singers on radio shows. And then it comes to a head in the 1950s and 60s when Nashville changes its style. And there were a lot of fans that have even written letters, and there's some wonderful scholarship by a woman named Diane Pecknold that looks back at some of the fans in the 1950s and 60s. And they were absolutely passionate about the divide between country that was too pop for them or country that was too twangy for them. So that tension that we hear about today, it goes way back.
That's so interesting, because many people would think it was something relatively new, but it goes back that far. And in fact, an artist, we look back now at Patsy Cline, and many people think of her as a traditional country singer and sort of a prototype, I guess. But in fact, at the time, there was some controversy with her because she wasn't exactly what country music was supposed to be.
Absolutely. According to some fans, she wasn't what it was supposed to be. And she was recording at the exact moment in history when we had changes in technology, and suddenly we were getting regularly overdubbing on the recordings and a lot more of our stereo recordings that we're, of course, used to today, but that was pretty new in the 50s. And she was working with producers who were trying some radical new things with instrumentation and bringing in large string sections and backup singers, and the whole sound was changing. And today we look back at her as this icon of traditional country, and at the time she was very much a controversy in terms of pop music. And I think her biographers have also explored very well the fact that in her own career that tension was in place. She talked about always wanting to sing more traditional country music, and she loved covering songs. She actually recorded a Hank Williams tune. She records Bob Wills tunes. So she's trying in her own career sometimes to cover this more traditional country, and yet songwriters are being asked to provide her with material that has an accessibility to a broader pop audience. So even in her own career, there's that tension.
Very interesting. Now, these artists, of course, the big place for them is the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, Tennessee, where artists even today, they look up to it, and it's a great honor to play there because all the greats, of course, have played there before. What is the role of the Grand Ole Opry for those who aren't too familiar, and how did it sort of get its importance in the music of country music?
So the Grand Ole Opry serves, I think several authors have used the metaphor of a church, sort of a mother church, or this place of pilgrimage importance in country music fandom. And its history, it starts broadcasting in 1925 in Nashville on WSM, and it gets its name about 2 years later. And they did a couple of things, very, very fortunate things in those early years. The radio executives hired a terrific MC to be the host of the Opry. And so you had a great person who was very good at publicity and very good at making sure the Opry had what we would describe now as a brand name recognition. But the Opry really developed in its importance several decades later. There were a lot of radio shows, a lot of barn dance shows in the 20s and 30s, and even the 1940s, that gave it a run for its money. Chicago had the National Barn Dance, and there were lots of other shows that were very well known. But Nashville starts to develop this importance in the genre because it's this nexus of a number of different aspects of the industry. There was a big publishing business already set up in Nashville. It's known for publishing outside of music as well. But there was publishing there. Then the Opry happened to be there, so there was a place for artists to play. And then it's centrally located to a large percentage of the American population in the 1940s and 50s. So you could work out of Nashville if you're an artist. And using just day trips, you could tour, and that's how most of the people actually made their money. The Opry wasn't paying them a fortune, of course, back then. And so you could tour, and you could concertize with audiences that could hear the Opry, and that's how they got to know your name, and then you could go out and play a show for them. So it's geographically located in a good place. It had music publishing. It had the radio station there. And then it also had, and this was really important for the artists, it started to have the recording industry centered there as well. So some of the better recording studios and your sound engineers took up root there. And that meant that you then had musicians in town as well who became specialists as sessions players. So all those forces sort of converge in this one place. But until probably the 1950s, Nashville hadn't really emerged as the single geographic center for country music. Once that did happen, then, of course, the Opry becomes the voice of Nashville that's easily heard on your Saturday night airwaves, and that really helped the Opry to take on an even greater importance in sort of the mythology of country music for its fans.
And it's so great to have that, because those of us who've watched it on Saturday nights when they televise it, to be able to see that, and of course people who go there and see it live, you've got that institution that connects the past and the present, and the current artists go there, and the older artists as well. So it's a great, it unifies it and sort of gives it that enduring history.
Absolutely, and of course the Opry has worked very hard to maintain that. When they moved locations in 1974 out to a more suburban but much nicer facility as well, they cut a circle out of the stage of the Ryman Auditorium, which is in downtown Nashville and which had housed the Opry for about 30 years at that point. And they took it with them because it was so important for the artists to be able to stand literally on the stage that their idols had stood on. And so there's a lot of the ways that the Opry has helped foster that sense of strong tradition as well.
Now, one of the artists, of course, when we think about country music and those of us who love it, one of the great legends, George Jones, with so many great songs, and many artists say he sort of, taught them what a male country singer should sound like, and he can do the heartbreak to the novelty songs. What is George Jones' legacy for all his years in country music?
Oh, it's enormous. As you've just mentioned, he runs the gamut in terms of styles, and he's been recording for decades and decades. A lot of fans will know sort of one period of George Jones's work, but he started recording as sort of a rockabilly artist in the 1950s. And some of those hits, people don't remember if they know him more from his 1970s work, which was when he did a lot of the heartbreak tearjerker songs.
Right.
And then he happens to record in 1980 the song that on a lot of people's lists is the best country song ever, and that's He Stopped Loving Her Today. And so we have that kind of career-making song following almost three decades at that point, of other songs and other hits that helps. And I think country music fans in general love the stories of the artists' lives as well. And so you've got these storied romances in a lot of the artists' personal lives. People remember Johnny Cash and Jude Carter. People remember George Jones and Tammy Wynette, even though that marriage didn't last. So you've got these stories as well that really helped some of these artists become just major figures in their fans' memories.
And we see George go through the troubled times to ultimate redemption when he marries again to his wife Nancy and sort of gives up some of those earlier troubled ways of his. But the song you touched on, He Stopped Loving Her Today, again, it tops the list, many people's lists, as sort of the best country song, the most country song. And it is a great song. It covers sort of it's the theme of it's taking dying for a man to get over his lifelong love. That's really impacted on people's lives, and it's got a lot of meaning for them.
Absolutely, absolutely. A lot of fans look at that song, and they appreciate the poetry in it, that it doesn't tell you right up front what's happened, and you have to pay attention to the lyrics and say, oh, yeah, he's dead. And a lot of students, I love playing that song in class, a lot of students will have heard it, but not really listened to the words or not caught the imagery or the symbolism that says, oh, he's passed away. There was no way to get over that misery, that heartbreak, until death. And they realize that, and then the song even hits them harder.
Yeah, I've heard that, and in fact, in my case, too, when I heard that years and years ago, I was quite young, it took me to a certain point to realize, okay, he died. Because you don't necessarily, unless, like you say, you listen very closely, realize that, and then it really pulls you in even more.
Absolutely, and I think that a lot of country songs have that level of sort of abject misery in them. And I think that the fans recognize that that's almost a trope in country music, and it doesn't mean that all of us really want to be in such a heartbroken situation that we're going to be miserable till the day we die. There's something about the imagined excesses and imagined extremes that we value in our music. And we don't want it to be too personal. We don't really want George Jones to be that miserable until he drops dead.
Exactly. And that's an interesting thing, because people maybe who don't listen to country music might think of it as very sad and different things. But as you said, you know, we enjoy listening to a very sad song, but it doesn't necessarily make us sad or want to be sad. We just enjoy the poetry and the sentiment and just the way it moves us.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot in both the humor and in the pathos and the emotionalism of country music that insiders or fans understand very differently than people who only see country music as something they would never personally invest in, or something that they could almost describe as a caricature.
Right. And so often I've run into people who may have said that they didn't like country music, they don't like it, and then it took an artist or two, maybe it was Garth Brooks, or maybe it's Taylor Swift, and all of a sudden they start listening and realizing what they thought it was isn't actually what is played on the radio or wherever they hear the music.
Absolutely. And the other thing I like watching with fans is they'll say, I don't like country music, but then they'll confess to liking some artists who other people might describe as country. For instance, Johnny Cash. There'll be a lot of fans who say, yeah, I don't like country music, but I love Johnny Cash. Sometimes
right.
Willie Nelson has that same group of fans. Oh, I don't like country music, but I love Willie Nelson. And
yeah.
So sometimes the idea of the genre is a little bit separate in a fan's mind than the actual music they like.
Very, very true, very true. Now videos came along. Of course, George Jones and Patsy Cline and those guys. Well, George Jones got into videos, but not in the early part of his career. How did videos affect country music? Did it, I guess the artist had to start to appear better, look better, and not just sing well?
Absolutely, and it depends how we define videos, because a lot of the artists were making movies and were making shorts. I mean, even back to Jimmy Rogers, he actually even made a little short movie that has three songs in it with him sitting there and playing and singing, which is, I guess, a sort of form of the visual and the audio combined in the way we think of music
right.
videos. But that happened in the 1980s, for the most part. The country fans were affected very much like the pop, the country musicians were affected very much like the pop musicians were affected. It gave them a new medium through which to tell stories. Whether or not it required them to look better, I think that was television had already done that. And we look back at the way the artists change in their imagery, and that happens back in the 1960s when country music television shows became very popular. But I think that the music videos added that layer of storytelling in the visual aspect that allowed country music to take a real place in pop culture in the 1980s, where if it hadn't started to make videos, it wouldn't have been able to compete in that same visual storytelling marketplace with pop music.
True. Now, Garth Brooks, of course, came along, and he made some very popular videos. Some of them were controversial, the Thunder Rolls, but they were always done artistically and very well. What is Garth Brooks' legacy, even though he's come out of retirement just recently? He's going to start making new music. But when we look back, it's hard to believe retiring at such a young age. What is his biggest contributions to the music?
Oh, gosh, I think he's retired several times already. I think he retired about 9 years ago, and then he's retired several times since then. So, yeah.
Great way to get a bit
skeptical.
Of publicity, retire.
Yes,
yeah, retire and come out of retirement.
He announces, I'm never sure about that. But Garth Brooks, again, hits at a time in history, and I'm always interested in sort of the context around the artist's emergence in the scene. But so he basically starts making records and videos in 1989, and he follows the same larger trends in the country in the early 90s if we look at politics, and there's a turn towards the South as a place the country's paying attention to. And, you know, 2 years, 3 years later, we actually elect a Southern president in the United States. I realize most of your listeners are probably up in Canada. But down here, the politics were changing, and there was we're looking at an economic recession in the early 90s, and during economic recessions, some fans say that country music is representing all that's wholesome and you know, back to the simple life. And so we sometimes
right.
find a little boost in country music listenership during those times. So Garth Brooks was sort of at the right time, right place. And his other interesting contribution was he's pretty much the first generation of artists, and certainly the most famous of the artists, whose description of the music they loved didn't just follow a country lineage. And so he talked about listening to George Strait and George Jones, but he also talked about listening to Journey or Foreigner or some of the big stadium bands of the 70s and 80s. And so he changed the way that country music was interested in entertaining its fans. And the things that a lot of historians have pointed out was he said, okay, if you're going to buy a ticket, come to my show, I'm going to put on an entertainment show. It's some glitz and some special effects and
right.
things of that nature. And I think his videos also show that even from the beginning, he wasn't interested in staying within any kind of boundary of country music. The video I think is most telling of that is the dance. And his following imagery in that video, he's got images of Martin Luther King Jr. and images of the space shuttle crew and images that basically don't have anything to do with traditional country music, but that have to do with a much larger artistic point he was trying to make. So he was not limiting himself in any way to a country identity, even from those very, very early recordings.
And he took that song, The Dance, which when originally written and when we listen to the song without the video, it's basically about a dance, just going to a regular dance. But he took it to mean the dance of life, basically, and as you stated in that video, capturing those moments. And he did that with a lot of his music. He made it very poignant. And songs like The Dance, The River, hard to think of them all at the moment. But
Standing Outside the Fire was another one.
Yes.
And
exactly.
We Shall Be Free. And that one he managed to spin into some really nice publicity there when he introduced that song and talked about it as representing a whole bunch of different aspects, not only of personal freedom, but also of romantic freedom.
That's right.
That was a pretty famous controversy for him.
Yeah, he took, and maybe he was one of the first ones to sort of take songs that were controversial, but also sort of were life-affirming.
I'm always hesitant to say he was really the first. There were a lot of other artists that would sing songs with, you know, double meanings and metaphoric important things, but he certainly was the biggest of the artists to do that.
And he had those NBC specials early on, too, which brought a lot of fans to him that might not have otherwise known of him if they didn't turn on country radio. Here he was on NBC with these big concerts doing the big stadium thing, and if you flipped through and saw it, you were drawn in. I know a lot of people became Garth Brooks fans through that.
A lot of people write about liking Garth Brooks when they were surprised they liked Garth Brooks. You know, they never thought they'd like
right.
country music, but what they were remembering was a stereotype of it. But I think his career also reminded me of some things artists had done earlier. Dolly Parton springs to mind. You know, in the mid-70s, she started to do Vegas shows. She had her own television shows, and she was changing her image so that it had fewer associations with a real strong country identity and more of a pop star. And she was going to Hollywood and starting to make movies. And in the late 70s, we have not only Dolly Parton, but also people like Willie Nelson suddenly showing up in movies, taking on Hollywood. So Garth Brooks was the biggest of his generation, but I think a lot of the things that he did, other really savvy artists had done a little bit earlier as well.
I'm speaking with Dr. Jocelyn Neal, and she is an associate professor of music at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's written a couple of great books, The Songs of Jimmie Rodgers, A Legacy in Country Music, which received an ASCAP Deems Taylor Award. She also co-authored the third revised edition of Country Music USA. And we talked about videos. Well, at the box office, of course, country music has done quite well there, going back to Coal Miner's Daughter, Tender Mercies, more recently Walk the Line, Crazy Heart, Country Strong, a brand new one I think is coming out in the new year with Gwyneth Paltrow. Well, what has been the impact of country music at the box office, and have they got it? Have they got it right? Have they captured what country music is, or have they changed it at all?
I don't know if they've got it right or not, but they certainly are keeping the fans happy. I don't know if you mentioned Urban Cowboy in there, but I think that's another
right.
really
oh, exactly.
important one. That launched a huge wave of interest in country music in the early 80s, and basically a lot of people learned how to two-step because of that movie. And back when you know John Travolta is showing up as a sort of country character, those soundtracks
exactly.
were very well known as well. I think that country music has a basic story that resonates with your Hollywood audience, and that is you know, there's always a story of the underdog there, and there's always a story of somehow redemption. You mentioned redemption earlier in relationship to some artists' personal lives, but that general story of personal redemption becomes a major trope in country music, and it translates beautifully to the big screen. And I think we've seen a lot of country movies coming in waves. So there were a bunch of movies in the early 90s. George Strait did a movie which has also been translated into a Broadway show that he got to basically play the ideal country character who realizes as a country star that he doesn't want to sell out. He doesn't want to be just commercial. He really wants to take it back to the roots and back to the heart. And I think that
right.
particular narrative, you know, we've seen that over and over in country music movies. They play beautifully in the box office. And I think the big question is always whether or not the producers choose to bring a country star in to act in the movie or if we choose to bring an actor in and have them sing country music, which you mentioned the new Gwyneth Paltrow movie that's coming out next
yeah.
spring. And that's the big question there is it's a lot of marketing and PR done for that film, but unlike some of the others, they've got somebody who's not known as a country star playing a country star.
That's right. And so, you know, we can accept them acting out a part, but now I know in Gwyneth's case, because she was on the Country Music Awards, of course, and many people have heard the song Country Strong, so she is a good singer, but, you know, to know that it's an actor singing there's a little authenticity maybe missing.
I think it's always a question of what do we mean by actor and what do we mean by singer. People loved Jeff Bridges and Crazy Heart for the most part. So, you know, why couldn't we think of these people as country singers if they're up there singing a country song? And I think it bothers some fans who want this idea of authenticity to be linked to something about career identity. Faith Hill ran into that problem when she started to do movies that weren't necessarily about country music at all, but a lot of her fans who had come to her music when she was really just singing country music, they were bothered by the fact that her career was branching out away from that. And she actually very consciously sort of brought it back to country music in about 2005 when she released an album that the song lyrics themselves were saying, yeah, I went to Hollywood, but no, I'm still a small town girl at heart. So it's a tricky balance with maintaining your fan base and yet still perhaps having the freedom to try something new in your career.
And in that movie, of course, we've got Gwyneth Paltrow. But we've also got Tim McGraw, who is a country star, and he's acted in several movies now. Dwight Yoakam has done the same thing. And, of course, George Strait was in that movie, Pure Country. So we've got country artists now becoming movie stars.
Absolutely. And that's, of course, happened earlier as well. Dolly Parton's a great example of that. I was really interested that when Gwyneth Paltrow sang that song Country Strong on the CMAs, they had Vince Gill on stage right next to her.
Right.
And so the country music establishment, sort of these big name stars who've been around for a long time, are clearly sort of in the mix and in the process of making that film. And I think that's going to give it more accessibility to an audience than if they weren't so visibly there and so visibly participating. But you also mentioned something I find really intriguing, and that's the way that gender identity works in country music. The stars that you just named as having that kind of dual career are often male stars.
Right.
And the way that fans look at their male stars and their female stars are not always the same in country music.
Interesting. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Sure, I'm always intrigued to take a look at, say, the Billboard country charts each week and see what percentage of the songs in the top 20 or in the top 30, perhaps, are sung by female artists. And
right.
The numbers haven't changed that much in the last 30 years, and it's usually between 20 and 25%, which is surprising to some fans because there are some female stars that are just huge. If you say Carrie Underwood or Taylor Swift, I mean, these are household names. Even non-country fans know, and we think of them as enormously popular stars. The same thing's true for somebody like Reba McEntire, who's been on the charts now for approaching 30 years. But if we look at the way that country fans sort of value and evaluate their stars and their careers, sometimes it's a little bit different. You know, Faith Hill got a lot of flack for going to Hollywood and doing movies. Tim McGraw has gotten less of that from the majority of the fans.
Right. Very interesting perspective on that. Now, country music, of course, so popular that many artists from other genres decide to go country. Alan Jackson sang with that and gone country. And with varying degrees of success over the years, people have crossed over. I mean, you had artists like Kenny Rogers who sort of walked that line between pop and country. But, you know, we're looking at Jessica Simpson recently. Bon Jovi recorded what first they say was a country album. Then I've heard John Bon Jovi say, well, it was just an album they recorded in Nashville, kind of backed away from it a bit. And it's always good to do if it doesn't work, back away a bit. And Darius Rucker now, of course, of those three, Darius Rucker has just done amazing at country music. And can you sort of discuss why Darius and not Jessica or Bon Jovi?
It's always tricky to try and explain why someone makes it and somebody else doesn't.
Right.
It's very difficult to quantify that. I like the fact you started out mentioning Kenny Rogers because he had some recordings with First Edition and was really working it on a pop career, and he wasn't the only one. Back at the beginning of his career, I think Conway Twitty started out similarly in a much more rock and pop scene, and so did Waylon Jennings, who's somebody that a lot of fans think of as the epitome of outlaw country.
Right.
So there have been a lot of artists all the way back who have moved across these genre boundaries quite fluidly and quite successfully. I don't think you mentioned Jewel in the parade of artists right now who are sort of entering Nashville or trying to.
There's another one.
And she's in that list as well. It's a big list. One of the things that Darius Rucker has done for his fans is talked very compellingly about the aspects of the country identity that he just personally connects with, you know, sort of a Southern, down-home, good old boy kind of upbringing. And when he talks about those things, it sounds like, well, yeah, sure, he must have been a country singer all along at heart, because those are the things that, that we look for in country singers. You know, do they
right.
connect with the small town and the home and the family and all of these aspects of country music's identity? And he's done a very, very nice job of that. Some of the other stars perhaps have not been as convincing in that particular question. And I think there's
exactly.
I hate to come back to the gender idea, but I think there is a little bit of a question there. Some of the pop stars who have been the least successful in trying to break in to country music are very attractive female stars. Now, there are exceptions. One could point out that Shania Twain had started out in pop music and made some recordings that were very decidedly pop records before she
That's
came
right.
to Nashville and before she tried to go country. But again, she never really ended up with a very traditional country identity. She was always in a country pop style.
Definitely, definitely. And as you said off the top there, quantifying these things, why an artist takes off, maybe why a song becomes the number one hit. We've got exceptions like Whiskey Lullaby, which most people probably would have predicted wouldn't have become a hit because it's the subject matter. So a lot of this stuff is kind of hard to, you know, it looks good on paper, but it doesn't always work.
Absolutely, and the novelty hits are the trickiest in that collection. But Kid Rock is a country singer. A lot of people sort of raise their eyebrows and say, what, really?
Yeah, exactly.
And yet I remember seeing him on some awards shows, you know, with Hank Williams Jr. I remember him talking about the influence of both Southern rock and traditional country music on him long before he
yeah.
started making records that were being pitched to country radio. And so there was a way in which the people who'd already heard his name and who'd already been listening to him maybe had that idea already planted in their heads that this was a person who had some kind of, in his mind, very strong connection with the genre already.
Right. Yeah, I think it is the kind of genre. It's sort of a family, and we want to feel that somebody coming into that family likes the music and knows a bit about the music, and that goes a long way to endearing us as fans. In the case of Kid Rock, knowing that he has that history with Hank Jr. But if somebody, I think, came on the scene and we kind of got the feeling that they were just in it to cash in but didn't have any respect for the format, I think fans would turn away pretty quickly.
Absolutely. I like the fact that you use that word respect there. That's something that we always
yeah.
look for as fans and our country singers is, are they respecting the tradition? And are they, you know, performing on the Opry with the what the fans assume is sort of the proper reverence, the proper respect for the traditions that they're joining? I noticed that a lot of artists, not necessarily ones that are crossing in from pop, but just a lot of new artists, they're very careful to make sure that their fans do know who their idols are and who they listen to and who they respect. And a lot of times they do that in concerts by covering the songs of some of those famous country singers from a previous generation.
Yes. Yeah, I've always loved seeing that on award shows or whatever the show might be, seeing the new artists cover the classics. It's that respect. And I mean, they're such timeless songs. It's great to hear them brought to the present.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, do you have a favorite country song? I mean, probably impossible to pick one, but do you have maybe one or two that come to mind for various reasons?
Oh, it's totally impossible to pick, and it probably changes day to day by what I'm hearing. I always like songs that have a lyric twist to them. We were talking earlier about George Jones, and I just think that one of the songs that always makes me smile is the Corvette song, because
yes.
it's the song where he describes this wonderful thing, and you can't tell if it's a car or if it's a woman. And it's both or it's neither. And I think that the songwriting for me, and I'm glad you asked about the songwriting, because the songwriting in country music is what just, you know, makes me smile and keeps me coming back and keeps me doing more research and looking further. It's a wonderful art form. So I love the songs where there's a twist or where there's a surprise. We even talked about with He Stopped Loving Her Today, you know, when do fans figure out in that song what's really going
yeah.
on? I really enjoy those studies of narrative for me in the song lyrics and the songwriting itself.
And country is so much about the songwriting, and that's what everybody realizes. The songs are deep in a lot of cases. Sometimes they're not. They can be novelty songs, but the writing is always great, and it's more than just a baby type of thing. It's always really well written lyrically and the music as well, of course.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not willing to say that, you know, pop music songwriting is any less sophisticated or clever. It's just
yep.
different. But I remember when I very first was visiting Nashville, and people kept saying, it's a writer's town, it's a writer's town. This was, you know, decades ago, and I was just very first visiting Nashville. And I thought, you know, it really is. It's a writer's town. And I've been very fortunate. I've had a lot of great guest artists come to UNC and speak to my classes and perform on campus for the students and whatnot. And my favorites, hands down, are the songwriters. They're to me, the generative force behind country music. And a lot of times the fans don't even know their names. I love the way that a lot of us associate a song with the artist who's singing it on the radio hit.
Right.
And sometimes we're even absolutely wedded to the idea that absolutely that artist is singing first person about something he or she wrote, and it's not. It's a songwriter's name we don't even know who's living in Nashville or who's living somewhere totally different. It's their either personal experience or poetic experience. But I think
that is so interesting.
All around keeps me really intrigued.
Oh, it is so intriguing because, as you say, many people think it's the artist. They think, oh, George Strait, he's a great songwriter. They just assume. But in so many cases, it's these great writers who aren't famous, who work sort of behind the scenes, but in some cases do quite well. If they've written, you know, several number one songs, of course, they can make a pretty good living at that.
They can make a very good living at it. I think that the economic structures of popular music are such that it's still about copyright and publishing. I mean, yes, I'm not saying that the big stars aren't making some money while they're singing. Of course they are, and that's the way that our system works, and that's great. But the songwriters, you know, there's still a system in the economics of the music business that really rewards the songwriters of the hits. When a song gets played on the radio, there's money that gets funneled back through the publishing and through the royalties to the publisher and the songwriter. In a way that's really important. And so a lot of us aren't really thinking about that all the time. It's the songwriter whose name we don't even know that was the generative force behind that. Now, of course, it takes a good performance to sell that story to us as well and to make us, you know, believe it and get emotionally invested in it. But those songwriters are really creative people.
Yep. Exactly.
We were talking
you need
about
that
Hank Williams as a songwriter. Yes. If we think about Jimmy Rogers, we think of him, yes, as a performer, but also because we remember the songs he wrote that have been covered over and over and over.
Very cool. And a great note to end on. We're just out of time, Jocelyn. It's been such a pleasure talking. I'd love to have you back. We covered a lot of topics, but of course there's always much more to cover in country music. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you. It was a real treat to be here tonight.
Awesome. My guest today has been Dr. Jocelyn Neal, an associate professor of music at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's the author of The Songs of Jimmie Rodgers, A Legacy in Country Music, and she's also co-author of Country Music USA. I'm Dave Woods. If you have comments on this show, you can always email me, and the email address is inthecountry@mail.com. Thanks for joining me on this edition of In the Country.
In the country, we're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country, leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone, the best in music too. Spend some time in the country, we've been waiting.